Good morning, everybody. I'm one of the many Joshes that is inevitably here every year. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. I live in Atlanta, so I don't know a lot of you guys. Some of your faces are familiar. I look around the room, and I sort of know a bunch of you and don't really know most of you. And I imagine the reverse is true as well. So I just want to say I appreciate all you guys making a point to be here for this weekend today, especially on a Saturday. Saturdays are precious. And so I appreciate you guys giving up that time to study through the book of Ruth. Ruth 3 is where we're going to be for this next 45 minutes or so. So if you want to go ahead and just kind of zero in on that text. Ruth 3, if you've ever read it, if you're familiar with it, you may be perplexed by it, as many of us are. It reads kind of oddly, if I'm being honest with you. It probably wasn't until preparing for this that I feel like I sort of know what's going on. But I'm not going to lie to you, I'm not sure I totally know what's going on. But let me ask this. Who enjoys, you can raise your hand if you feel comfortable doing that, who enjoys asking people for help? That's what I thought. Who enjoys telling other people how you feel when they're unsure how they feel about you? That's kind of what I thought too. Ruth chapter 3 is basically a story about both of those things happening kind of simultaneously. And so when you read it, not only is it potentially weird or awkward for those reasons, but then there's also major cultural differences between us as readers today and the narrative of Ruth 3. And so it's just one of those chapters that kind of falls flat in a lot of ways. Like when you read it, you're like, I don't totally understand what's going on. Also, seems weird, awkward, maybe inappropriate. I'm not really sure how to feel about this. And so just know, even if the person to your left and your right thinks you're dumb for thinking that, I'm on board. I agree with you. It's a little weird when you read it. But don't let that discourage you from understanding it. I think it is understandable. You have to put in a little bit of work. But also, more importantly, beyond being understood, is it has a meaning that resonates eternally. And we're going to talk about that as well. I also want to say this. It's a lot of sitting when you're at an event like this. So if you need to stand up, stretch your legs, walk around to wake up, you're not going to bother me. And I assume everyone's mature enough to handle people getting up and needing to do that. So feel free to do that. I'm not going to judge you for needing to stand up so you don't fall asleep. So just wanted to throw that out there. All right, so let's read this chapter. It's not as long as, say, chapter 2. And so we should be able to read it fairly quickly. And overall, the events of the chapter are not a lot of them. It's kind of a singular event. And so we should be able to kind of grasp what's going on, as odd as it is, fairly quickly. So let's go ahead and begin this reading. Ruth 3, beginning in verse 1. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, should I not seek rest for you that it may be well with you? Is not Boaz our relative with whose young women you were? See, he's winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Wash therefore and anoint yourself and put on your cloak and go down to the threshing floor, but don't make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. But when he lies down, observe the place where he lies. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do." And she replied, "All that you say, I will do." So she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain. And then she came softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. And at midnight, the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. And he said, "Who are you?" And she answered, "I'm Ruth, your servant. Spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer." And he said, "May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, don't fear. I will do for you all that you ask, for all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. And now it is true that I am a redeemer. Yet there is a Redeemer nearer than I. Remain tonight and in the morning. If he will redeem you, good. Let him do it. But if he's not willing to redeem you, then as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until the morning. So she lay at his feet until the morning. But arose before one could recognize another, and he said, let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. And he said, bring the garment you are wearing and hold it out. And so she held it, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and put it on her. Then she went into it. Then she went into the city. And when she came to her mother-in-law, she said, how did you fare, my daughter? And then she told her all that the man had done for her, saying, these 6 measures of barley he gave to me, for he said to me, you must not go back empty-handed to your mother-in-law. And she replied, wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but settle the matter today. All right, so if this is your first time reading Ruth, it's odd, right? You're like, what is going on? I don't really understand this whole, like, plan, which is basically all that unfolds in chapter 3, is Naomi comes up with the plan, and Ruth is like, okay, I'm going to do it exactly like you said to do it. And by the end of it, you're like, well, it worked, whatever it was, right? And not only did it work, she was, like, given gifts, and, like, he was happy about it, and you're like, okay, whatever. We're going to talk about maybe some of the thinking, the reasoning that goes into this, some of the cultural stuff. So stay with me on that. Don't fall asleep during that part. It's important. But a little bit of what's going on in this chapter is determined by the setting, which we've talked about. I mean, we know that Ruth has come to Bethlehem from being in a land that is near, but not her own country, or not her mother's country. She's gone back to her mother-in-law's place. Now she's in a place that's unfamiliar to her, and so Naomi's kind of calling the cultural shots, right? She's like, hey, you know, you can go to this field and you can glean, and Boaz has been good to her and allowed her to do that and let her kind of become a maidservant and be taken care of. We've talked a little bit about how the cultural situation, the economic situation is not so bright for a woman that is a widow, particularly an older woman like maybe Naomi would be, unable to remarry and have a family. And so these things are definitely in play. And so Ruth has been the provider in a lot of senses. She's the one going to the fields, doing the work, receiving what is needed for her and Naomi. Well, of course, in this, we have mentioned in chapter 2 and in this chapter allusions to this wheat and barley harvest. I'm not a farmer. I don't know when that kind of stuff happened. So I had to look it up, and it looks like in Israel, and in those times particularly, this would have been like the April-May time frame. So she's been working under Boaz's care for several weeks now, maybe as much as 2 or 3 months. And so Boaz has really had an opportunity to not only, ample opportunity to provide for her over the several weeks, but maybe even get to know her or know of her. Even the town has kind of had opportunity to allow her story to circulate and kind of know of her plight, because he mentions that a little bit later. But importantly, Ruth has also gotten to know how Boaz operates. She's seen him care for not only her, but other people like her in her situation. Even his own servants, as was mentioned in chapter 2 by Josh Hartzell, how he cared for people under him. And so that's informing all of this as we begin chapter 3. And so Naomi's like, look, it's been several weeks, and so you can see how she might conjure up this plan. My daughter, should I not seek rest for you, that it may be well with you? Is not as are those whose young women you were. She's been with him for several weeks. They know who Boaz is. He relates to them in a literal sense, like a blood relative. They figured that out. But they also know his character. And so this plan is hatched. But before we talk about the plan itself, let's talk about Naomi's desire for Ruth. In verse 1, laid out for us, she wants Ruth to have security or to have rest, depending on the translation you're looking at. I think that's a totally fair desire for Naomi to have, and I think it's even fair and reasonable for Ruth to have that desire for herself. Don't we all desire that? I mean, we want the job offer that provides the best, right? Not only money, but security, like future. We talk about that. Like, what are the opportunities? What kind of advancements might we have? We look at leaders, political, economic leaders. We want those leaders to be able to offer us a hope of a future, of security, right? Well, it makes a lot of sense for Naomi to be thinking in those terms, because everything that we know about Ruth and Naomi up to this point reveal that this is not something that they've had recently. They haven't had a lot of security. They haven't had a lot of rest. Ruth is literally working in a field day in and day out. And so this opportunity seems to be one that Naomi is unwilling to pass up. Should I not seek these things for you, she says in verse 1, that it may be well with you? Well, of course. Is not Boaz our relative with whose young woman you were? Well, yeah, he is. All right, so here's the plan. See, he's winnowing barley tonight at the threshing floor. Wash, therefore, and anoint yourself, and put on your cloak and go down to the threshing floor, but do not make yourself known to the man until he's finished eating and drinking. And when he lies down, observe the place where he lies, then go and uncover his feet and lie down, and he will tell you what to do. First of all, Naomi's really bold in making this plan in that, like, she expects Boaz to respond favorably, which I think is probably an assumption, but that has been mitigated by his character over these several weeks. Like, he's proven to be someone that she could kind of gamble on in this way. But it is that. I think it is like a gamble. This plan has to be involved. It is a bold plan. The plan, when we look at it, is basically that it is involving her going to where Boaz is, which happens to be the threshing floor, the place where they separate the grain from the rest of the stuff you don't eat, the chaff, and basically kind of spend time with him, but then when he goes to sleep, kind of make your move, like go lay down at his feet. Weird story for me. What we need to understand about this is some of this context. Why would Boaz be at the threshing floor? Why would he sleep at the threshing floor? Like, doesn't he have a house? Isn't he like a pretty well-to-do guy? I think the answer to all that is yes. He has servants and he has a home and he probably has this big farm and these fields. Like, he has better places to sleep than the threshing floor. 1 Samuel 23, like verse 1, you don't have to turn there. I don't plan to read it. But there's a story about like the Philistines attacking people, and David's kind of expected to deal with them. And one of the things that they're doing is robbing threshing floors. And so I think this kind of reveals to us maybe why Boaz is doing this. In the time of the judges, which is not the most politically, spiritually, or economically stable time in Israel's history, it probably was a very real thing to have your threshing floors targeted by robbers or bandits. And so what seems likely is Boaz sleeps at his threshing floor, to perhaps in times of harvest when robbers would make note of that, sleep there to defend it. And so Boaz is doing just that, probably. And so that's where he's going to be tonight. He's going to be sleeping to protect his investment, to protect his livelihood. And so that's why it's occurring there. But the plan centers on the threshing floor, but it's also centering on this idea that, like, the timing is right. The presentation is right. I think Naomi understands a lot of things here. I think one of the things that she understands is male behavior in her time. She's like, make yourself nice, make sure you smell good, put on some nice clothes, don't bother him while he's eating. Right? Naomi knows what she's doing. And Ruth says, all right, I'm going to do it exactly like you say. Like, I'm going to get dressed. I'm going to smell good. I'm going to present myself after he eats, right? Make sure I catch him in the best mood. Now, the part that we don't understand maybe so much is this lying down at his feet at night. It seems weird. Even, to be fair, like when I make a first pass at this, maybe it's like sexually suggestive. That's how I read it. Maybe you're in the same boat, maybe you're not. did a lot of reading on this, and it seems like it was not at all that. And it involves an understanding of this redemption process for Israelites. This has been touched on, remarked on, but I want to dive a little deeper into what this is, because it's the cornerstone of this chapter. And really, in a lot of ways, is a cornerstone of the story of Ruth, is this idea that redemption is possible, and not only is it possible, it's available. Not only is it available, it's desired. Like, you kind of have that process revealed in the book of Ruth. So let's talk a little bit about this. You might think it's inappropriately forward for Naomi to suggest this plan. Like, it just seems really forward and bold and inappropriate to do it this way. And it's even possible to think that Naomi plotted with Ruth to kind of make a man trap. You know, like, you go get you a man, you go lay down at his feet, he'll wake up in the middle of the night and he's stuck with you, you know? Word will get out in town that you spent the night there, and like, he, as a man of his word, will have to just kind of take you on, right? That's not what's happening here. She's not hunting down a reluctant Boaz, as we see in the text, and we'll talk more about that in a moment. It's all rooted in this concept of a kinsman redeemer. And we need to talk about this for a moment. In Leviticus chapter 25 and verse 48, one of the roles of a kinsman redeemer in Israelite law, custom, teaching, tradition, however you want to phrase it, was that when an Israelite was sold into slavery for whatever reason, that person had the responsibility to buy them back out of it when the time came. Whoever was the nearest relative, this one that would be marked as a kinsman redeemer, had that responsibility. You're the one that goes, gets your family member, purchases them back out of slavery. That's in Leviticus 25, verse 48. Not only do they have that responsibility, they have the responsibility to buy back any kind of family land that may have been forfeited for whatever reason over the years. Right? God talks about that in Leviticus 25, just one, some verses earlier in verse 25. Leviticus 25, verse 25, he talks about that. That the kinsman redeemer not only is the one that buys back those who have been sold into slavery and their family, he buys back any land that's been lost. You know, the land wasn't supposed to be sold in perpetuity, but it could be, like, sold. It could be sold for a time. And if that land were to be redeemed, the kinsman redeemer was the one that would handle that. But not only that, there was more responsibility. In Numbers 35, there's this concept that there's an avenger of blood. You know, if a relative had been harmed or killed particularly, there's a family member that had the responsibility, or even the right, you might say, to bring a family murderer to answer for that crime. And the avenger of blood even had, under the right circumstances, had the right to take blood themselves. And so, this is a really big responsibility to be a kinsman redeemer. But the one that we kind of zero in on, the particular responsibility that Ruth is going to relate to, is the last one that I'm going to mention, is the responsibility to carry on a family name for a childless widow, for a man who was unable to have children and passed away, then that woman, his wife, would then be given to the nearest of kin, the kinsman redeemer, to be able to perpetuate that man's family's name. It was a really big deal in Israel to keep a name or a family going. And so that's the role that Ruth is going to end up appealing to from Naomi's advice. Elimelech, as is pointed out in chapter 2 and chapter 1, of course, is Naomi's deceased husband. And it seems like Boaz is the closest kinsman to them. And so he has a responsibility to kind of perpetuate this family name. And so that's the plan. That's the peculiar custom of Israel that God had given them, that Naomi is really informing Ruth about and asking her to appeal to. So even though, like, when I read this story, my personal feeling, my 21st century Atlantan's feeling, is that when I read this, I'm like, man, this is really forward and weird, this plan. But what Naomi is actually asking Ruth to do is to stake a claim. And the manner with which she's asking her to do it is supposed to kind of color that claim in humility and submission in a way that I don't totally understand as a man living in the United States in the 21st century, but that would have been very clear to any Israelite man having that claim staked, is to do it this way. And so what Naomi says is, hey, like, you're going to make a claim, you're going to appeal to Boaz on behalf of a right that you have within Israel, but you're going to do so in a humble and a submissive way. You're going to lay at his feet, right? And so that's Naomi's bold, and in our eyes, maybe forward or inappropriate plan that would have been totally normal in Israel. And so she comes up with the plan in the first few verses here. She reveals it to Ruth, and Ruth, being the woman that she is, I don't think any of us should be surprised. She's like, "Yeah, I'll do that. Right? All that you say, I'm gonna go do that." So this is when we start seeing the plan unfold, and really everything else in this chapter is a consequence of the first five verses. Like, Naomi lays out the plan. She even tells her how to do it. Make sure you wash yourself, you anoint yourself, don't bother him while he's eating, all that good stuff. And the rest of the chapter is basically the effect of fulfilling or living out this plan, this plot that Naomi has to bring Boaz's right or his responsibility to his attention. So let's zero in, beginning on verse 6 and kind of this next part. And I could sum it up as this. Verse 5, Ruth says, "Yeah, I'm going to do that." Verse 6, she does it. Right? Really what we want to focus in on the next part is Boaz's response to Ruth doing exactly what Naomi said. Right? So as we read this next section, key in on what Boaz says here. Verse 6, "So she went down to the threshing floor and did just as her mother-in-law had commanded her. And when Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap grain. Then she," that is Ruth, "came softly and uncovered his feet and lay down. And at midnight the man was startled and turned over, and behold, a woman lay at his feet. And he said, 'Who are you?' She answered, 'I'm Ruth, your servant. Spread your wing over your servant, for you are a redeemer.' And he said, 'May you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first, in that you have not gone after young men, whether poor or rich. And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you all that you ask, for all my fellow townsmen know that you are a worthy woman. And now it is true that I am a redeemer. Yet there's a redeemer nearer than I. Remain tonight, and in the morning, if he will redeem you, good, let him do it. But if he will not, if he's not willing to redeem you, then as the Lord lives, I will redeem you. Lie down until the morning.'" Remember, Ruth came to claim a right. She had every right to desire and to even ask Boaz to fulfill his duty. Right? The way that she does that is supposed to be, I believe, seen as a portrait of humility, of submission, to come quietly, to not make a big scene. You know, we can only imagine what it would look like if Ruth came in and just started yelling at him, being like, "Hey, you're supposed to take care of me. I'm a widow. We've been living in destitution for a couple months now, man. Like, this is your responsibility. Why haven't you done," you know, that'd be a whole different scene. This wouldn't be a story that we would want to emulate. It would not be a story that we would see godly characteristic in, value. But the way she does is she kind of slides in quietly. She's like, "I'm going to lay at his feet." She doesn't even wake him up. He just kind of wakes up and happens to see her there. Doesn't even probably in the night see who she is. Can you imagine if you're Boaz? You went to sleep on the threshing floor, potentially maybe concerned about robbers coming and stealing your stuff, and you wake up, and lo and behold, someone's actually there. You might have a moment where you're like grabbing a pitchfork or something, like, whoa, what's going on? Who's about to steal my junk, right? And turns out it's Ruth, and she's just been sleeping at your feet. Can you imagine the surprise and the relief to realize that it's just Ruth? In fact, what Boaz says when Ruth says, hey, I'm here, and this is the reason why I'm here, is interesting to me, and I think this colors how we interpret everything, even standing outside of their cultural context. It informs us in how we should be reading this by what Boaz says. He says, may you be blessed by the Lord, my daughter. You have made this last kindness greater than the first. Boaz grants a blessing upon realizing what's going on because he feels that he's received a blessing. And not only does he feel that he's received a blessing, he sees that even as a kindness. You know, sometimes we even today use this phrasing like of blessings, and we kind of mean that like general good things. But sometimes, like, we even talk about blessings in a negative light, and we're like, well, I know it's a blessing, but, you know, this has been going on, and I know God's challenging me, and I'm going to take it as a blessing. You know, we talk like that sometimes about things we don't like. That's not what Boaz is doing. He's seeing this as a kindness, as a blessing that Ruth has bestowed upon him to choose him to claim this right. I think the proper understanding of the kinsman redeemer is not that, like, there's one person in your family that does it, and if they don't do it, you're out of luck. It's the nearest person does it. And if in Leviticus chapter 25, was that Leviticus 25? Now I'm misremembering. Deuteronomy 25, excuse me. Deuteronomy 25, when this is hashed out, there's actually like a lot of people that could be this person. And they even have the right to not exercise this responsibility. They have that liberty. But in the text of Deuteronomy 25, if someone doesn't perform this responsibility, then they're like spit on and their sandals pulled off. And we'll talk more about that in chapter 4 happening. But there's like kind of a rebuke that comes with not performing this responsibility. And so Boaz could not do this. But it seems like he's actually excited to do it. Like he wants it. He sees it as a blessing and a kindness that Ruth would want him to do it. So as weird as the story is, I think we come to those realities, whether you already had that understanding or not, I think we see some beauty and some like quietness about this, understated humility, godliness involved in this account. And Boaz responds favorably. What a kindness, what a blessing. What a relief for it not to be robbers. There's the added benefit as well. But what we see in this additionally is this statement that Ruth makes about this, like, take me under your wing or your garment, depending on how your translation handles that. Let's look at that for a moment. She says, spread your wings over your servant, for you are a redeemer. This is not terminology that I've ever used. I'm married, and I didn't say, like, to my wife when we got married, like, I'm going to spread my garment over you. We have a phrase that's sort of similar, like, to take someone under your wing, but it's almost more like a counsel or a guidance more than anything when we say that. If I understand this correctly, it's more intimate than that. To say garment, undergarment even might be the idea, but to like spread your wing over someone was an idea of intimacy, relationship. In fact, God uses this imagery a lot. He uses it specifically, this phrasing even, to talk about his relationship with his people. In fact, in Ezekiel chapter 16, verse 8, he says this, I spread my wing over you, and covered your nakedness. Yes, I swore an oath to you and entered into a covenant with you, and you became mine, says the Lord God. I think that encapsulates the idea of this phrase. It's not like take me under your wing, like show me the ropes kind of idea, but it's like take me under your wing to make me yours and you mine and cover my nakedness, like take responsibility for my well-being, share a life with me, an intimacy with me. And that's what Ruth's coming to ask. I don't know if you guys have ever had that moment. I imagine most of you have, where you're trying to like detail a relationship with someone and you're trying to tell them like, hey, I'm interested in you. Sometimes the conversation goes south really quickly. I've had a few of those, and you got to bail out kind of gracefully before it gets too weird. You know, can you imagine Ruth like waking this guy up, or he wakes up in the middle of the night and Ruth is like, oh, hey, like spread your wings over me. Like it's essentially a marriage proposal. Now, she is claiming a right. We don't need to lose sight of that. And that's weird for us to think that, like, I kind of sort of have to marry someone. But that's what she's doing. She's essentially saying, hey, like, marry me. And thankfully, Boaz is of such character that even when he's caught off guard, it's the middle of the night, he's not even in his house. He's, like, out on the threshing floor. He's probably been about robbers and stuff, that it's a blessing to him, that he doesn't lose sight of what's actually happening. In fact, he sees it as a kindness. And he understands what it means to spread his wings or his garments over someone. In some small way, he's already been doing that. He's already been taking care of her as much as he was culturally, rightfully allowed to do up to this point. And so Boaz sees the blessing in being able to do this in a real way, in being able to call her his own. Again, bold, bold move that Naomi plotted for Ruth and that Ruth actually pursued, but was not inappropriate. So we have this fusion or this melding of two things within Ruth. Her ability to live boldly, to do bold things, to be brave and courageous, but also at the same time, her humility and submissiveness throughout that process. Like, she is staking a claim, not in a way that I might be inclined when I have a claim or a right to something. And so I learned a lot from Ruth in this. We'll talk more about maybe some of the applications here in a moment. So Boaz responds favorably to Ruth. According to verse 10, the way that I read verse 10 is it seems like maybe there's an age difference between the two of them, and Boaz is significantly older because of the way he responds to her not having chosen younger men. I'm not totally sure about that, but perhaps that's an added layer to this, is he's surprised that she would choose him and is thankful for that. But apparently they both regard one another according to their character and not their looks. According to verse 11, if that wasn't already evident, that's a good verse to look at for that. And another thing that's easily overlooked in this, when we really begin to understand that Boaz sort of had a right, a responsibility to claim her as his and perpetuate Elimelech's household, was that he did not force himself on her. I'm not sure totally how this would have played out, like day-to-day lives of Israelites. I'm inclined to think not a lot of Israelites lived up to this responsibility just due to the spiritual nature of the country or state of the country at this point. But it's possible to conceive a reality in which Boaz felt he had a right, and in a spiritually destitute community, maybe no one would challenge him on it, that he just seizes anyone, you know, someone like Ruth, that appeals to him, claims her as his wife, whether or not she desires that, and just moves on with his life. It's possible to conceive an alternate version of this story, if he were not godly, that could have unfolded. But you'll notice in the way that he says things when Ruth surprises him in the middle of the night, that not only does he see it as a blessing, but in his statement about how she had not gone after young men, it seems like his eye's been on her for a while. Like, he has taken notice of her. He actually did know that he was a redeemer, which means he's already thought about it. But he hadn't forced himself on her. He wanted her to make her choice about what she was going to do. Because there was a redeemer closer than Boaz. And surely she knew it, but they chose Boaz. And so I think this is a beautiful picture not only of Ruth, but of how Boaz has allowed her to operate and has not forced himself on her. And here in the last few verses, before we finish discussing just the text, before we get into the quick applications, in verses 14 through 18, we might call Boaz a gentleman because any good gentleman, he doesn't send her away empty-handed. As she's leaving, and I'm not really sure how to properly read this, I'm not sure it really matters, he sends her away with 6 measures of some sort of grain. She apparently like puts it in her garment, like her cloak, so it can't be like too much, but apparently it's like 6 measures of some amount of grain that he sends her with. And when Naomi like sees Ruth, they kind of have a conversation about the gift that she's been given, because he said, look, you can't go back to your mother-in-law empty-handed. So Boaz proves himself a blessing even to her, not only in pursuing this relationship, but even in his dealings with her. He's always acted, I don't know if above board is the best phrasing of this, but he's always acted as a blessing to her at every step along the way, and even considered her in ways that expanded outward. Like he considered Ruth so carefully that he also considered Naomi by extension. And so Boaz is really thoughtful. So as we look at chapter 3, a lot of applications that we can make about this text. I would hope that you're already kind of working in your minds to think through some of this stuff for yourself. Because all of us have, obviously, our own lives to live. We have our own friends and family. We have our own temptations. We have our own strengths. We are our own selves. We are individuals. And so I can't make every application that this text might make for you, but I'm going to attempt a few broad ones. First of all, I want to look at Ruth. And I want you to put yourself in Ruth's shoes while I offer these applications. Because I think when we consider God's eternal plan, when we consider how the book of Ruth really is a reflection of Christ being our kinsman redeemer, I think we fall into Ruth's place. Now, that's not to say we can't make applications and plenty of them from Naomi or even Boaz, but Ruth is the most clear parallel to you and me, as we can see in this book, as we relate to Christ. And so there's a couple things that I want us to see in this. First of all, from verse 1, Naomi tells Ruth, "Should I not seek rest for you that it may go well with you?" You need to be seeking security and rest. Now, you're probably thinking, well, yeah, I already do that. I love sleeping in on Saturdays. I would like to have a job when I graduate. That would be great. But obviously in a Bible study, hopefully you're turning your mind to something spiritual. Step number 1 in chapter 3, and I think for all of us in any kind of spiritual path, is to realize that security and rest is something that we need, and is something that should be and can be pursued. We maybe take that for granted, especially some of us that have grown up in homes that are spiritual. Maybe we take that for granted. But that's step number 1. Naomi informs Ruth of that necessity or of that need, that right. And we should recognize it as well. Ruth had no hope and no real life in the fields that she was working. We need to realize that whatever fields we're in, like in any kind of earthly, non-spiritual way, like wherever we find our hands and our time invested outside of the rest and security that our Redeemer provides, really offers no real hope, just like Ruth didn't have hope. It offers no real life, just as a life of cutting corners and fields didn't offer Ruth a life. There's no redemption to be found in that field or to be claimed. And so we seek something more. Just like in this life, We realize there's good things in this world, but ultimately we're seeking something more, just like Ruth was. The second thing is, as Naomi reveals to Ruth, there is a plan, and in fact, not only a plan, there's a method to redemption. Naomi details out some very specific things, like you go here, you look this way, you smell this way, you act at this moment, then you lay in this place, and you say these things, right? Like, she gives her a very specific method to carry herself in. She gives her even a detailed plan to claim this redemption, to find a kinsman redeemer in Boaz. And I think as we see ourselves in Ruth, we need to know that there's a method and there's a plan. Now, hopefully, that's like step 1B. Like, after you realize, hey, I need real security and I need real rest, is to also, right on the heels of that, realize, well, God's provided me a method and a plan to find that. But maybe that's one of those things you didn't know, and the off chance you didn't know it, that's true. But also don't overlook that. Most of us, we probably know something along those lines, like, hey, God has a method and a plan for me to find redemption. Don't overlook that. That was the key in Ruth 3 for her actually being taken under the wing or the garment of Boaz, is that Naomi had presented a method and a plan to bring this up, to claim this right, and God has similarly provided that for us. And while we could say the Bible is that plan or that method in a general sense, specifically we look at the teachings of the apostles and the life of Christ to see specifically the plans and the methods with which we can stake a claim, or we can claim our right to redemption and forgiveness in our kinsman redeemer, Jesus. And so we can see that in Ruth. But let's move over to Boaz here for a moment. What do we see in Boaz? I think the clearest parallel for Boaz is seeing him as a type or a shadow or a parallel, however you want to phrase that, to Jesus. And what we need to see in Boaz is, first of all, that he's the Redeemer. And simply put, Jesus is the Redeemer. I hope that all of us would understand that today, but also what we need to know about Boaz being the Redeemer and how he embodies Christ is that he is not only entitled the Redeemer, that he is willing to be the Redeemer, and he is able to be the Redeemer. There have been a lot of people that have wanted to be redeemers. They have wanted to be something that they are not, spiritually for the masses, that were unable to validate or support whatever hope or claim that they may have had. Because they were not supplied by God. They were not given authority or power to stake that claim. But Boaz, in this picture, not only is he the Redeemer for Ruth, he is willing and able to be the Redeemer for Ruth. And Jesus is abundantly, far more exceedingly able to be the Redeemer that we all need. And maybe more importantly, he's willing to be. He wants to do that just as Boaz wanted to do that for Ruth. And consequently, he's the right answer because he's willing and able to be. He's the right answer for your search for security and rest. He says just as much in Matthew 28, "Come, all who weary and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Put your yoke upon me." Right? That sounds a lot like, in light of Matthew 11, it sounds a lot like what Boaz has been offering Ruth. And we need to see that Jesus offers us the same. Also, I think it's important to see that as Boaz didn't force himself on Ruth, Jesus is not going to force himself on you. I think we need to understand it's fundamental to Jesus being the Redeemer is that also Jesus has to be chosen as such. He will respect, and speaking of Jesus, he will respect your decision to allow him to be your Redeemer just as much as he will respect your decision to reject him as your Redeemer. Now, certainly, just as Boaz operates in chapter 3, Jesus will be glad and he will bless, and all these other things that happen if you acknowledge that he's the Redeemer that you need and you come to him. But at the same time, just like Boaz hadn't forced himself on Ruth, Jesus is not going to force himself on you. He's not going to compel you in this that you have no choice in the matter. And so it's important for us to learn from Boaz as he's a kinsman redeemer to Ruth. He didn't force himself on her. Jesus does not force himself on us. He allows us to choose him. But we need to understand he is willing and he is able. Also, we need to understand Boaz desired intimacy. He did pursue Ruth's claim, or her request, rather, of him spreading his wing over her. He said, yeah, I'm going to do that for you. Jesus desires the same thing. I'm not going to go into detail on this because I think some others may say something along these lines. But if given the opportunity, Jesus will betroth himself to you. There's a lot of language that talks about that. We even talked about Ephesians 5, I think, last night, somewhat similar text to this idea. Hosea chapter 2, I mean, really the whole book of Hosea is about this concept. But Hosea chapter 2 relates to this directly. Another thing that we see from Boaz that shows us something about Jesus is that Boaz did not leave Ruth empty-handed. When we acknowledge that Jesus is the place that we need to go to for security and rest, and we choose him, we come to him as our kinsman, I think we can look at Boaz and see something very true about Jesus. And gave gifts after Ruth staked her claim with him. And I think Jesus gives us gifts as well. Jesus doesn't leave us empty-handed. First of all, I'm just going to pick one text. You don't have to turn there. Just think about this for a moment. One text that offers us this is in 1 John chapter 5. If you want to turn there, you can, but if you'd rather just listen to me as I read it, that's fine too. 1 John chapter 5 says this. 1 John chapter 5, verse 14. And this is the confidence that we have toward him, that if we ask anything according to his will, he hears us. And if we know that he hears us in whatever we ask, we know that we have the request that we have asked of him. Just as Boaz did not leave Ruth empty-handed, God will not leave us empty-handed when we come to him. He listens to our requests, as 1 John chapter 5 paints for us, and he doesn't deny them. Ruth had needs, and by extension, even Naomi had needs, and Boaz was compassionate and aware of those needs, and he supplied what he had towards them. Jesus, how much more abundantly could he do for us in a similar way? In fact, I believe the Gospels paint the picture that he does. In 1 John chapter 5, as we read, he answers prayers. Additionally, just as Ruth received gifts from Boaz and she took those gifts and supplied Naomi, we do something similarly when Jesus provides us with gifts. In fact, in Philippians chapter 2, they talk a little bit about this, but Jesus gives us gifts not just for ourselves, but so that we could take them to other people. In Philippians chapter 2, if you want to look there with me for a moment, it says this, beginning in verse 3, "Do nothing from rivalry or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourselves. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others." Well, certainly that was the mentality of Ruth all through the book of Ruth. And as Boaz blessed her because she had this attitude, she blessed Naomi. But where did the blessing come from? It came from Boaz in Ruth chapter 3, who is our Jesus figure. Certainly Jesus blesses all of us. And if we've chosen Jesus as our Redeemer and we're living in such a way that Jesus would have a relationship with us, we take the blessings, the gifts that Jesus offers us, and we bless other people as well. And so Boaz and Ruth demonstrate this for us. And finally, as far as applications, broad applications for us, Jesus, like Boaz, will not let us down. Look at the final verse of Ruth chapter 3 with me here for a moment. When Ruth had gone back to Naomi and revealed that she had received some barley from Boaz, this is what Naomi responds to Ruth with in verse 18. She replied, "Wait, my daughter, until you learn how the matter turns out, for the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today." Remember, he wasn't the nearest kinsman redeemer. He said, "There's one other. I'm going to go check with him. If he wants to marry you, great. If he doesn't, I'll do it." And so she sent back with some barley and is kind of waiting. It's like this interim period. Chapter 4 will deal with kind of the outcome of this. But as she's waiting, Naomi has these words to her that are very revealing about Boaz. And it says, wait until you learn about kind of how it's going to turn out. "For the man will not rest, but will settle the matter today." Jesus always keeps his word. God always keeps his word. And whatever hope that we have placed in him, as we wait to see the turnout, so to speak, we know that Jesus will settle it. There's this picture in the book of Revelation of like basically this exact same thing happening. There's a throne, and there's like, oddly enough, there's a bunch of martyrs under the throne, and they're like crying out like, how long, Lord, will you avenge our blood, right? And the expectation is that God would defend the poor, the oppressed, his faithful people, that he would be just to do that, that he would call just as he did in Genesis when blood cried out to him. They're making the same claim, like, our blood is crying out to you, Lord. Like, how long are you going to wait to avenge us? Well, God certainly makes the promise that he will. And so in the book of Revelation, they appeal to kind of this same mentality, this same place that Naomi is appealing, like, you know he's going to settle something, and all you have to do is to wait because he's not going to rest until it's settled. Jesus does the same thing for us. Whatever hope that we've vested in him, whatever words that he's spoken to us in kindness or in blessing, as we've come to him as our Redeemer, we can wait in peace. We can wait with confidence. We can wait with the blessings he's given us for the time, because we know that he does not rest until the matter is settled. He's not going to get lazy. He's not going to get tired. He's not going to be overcome by some circumstance or by some situation to where it won't shake out exactly as Jesus said it would. And so we need to understand that Boaz really has lived in such a way that is so Christ-like that even the way that he handles the matters with which he's pursuing, he's reflecting Jesus' character, his nature himself. And so I would hope that these things are helpful for you as we've been studying through Ruth, that you're seeing yourself in Ruth, that you're learning the lessons that she's kind of demonstrating for us in finding rest, turning to the kinsman redeemer. But I would also hope your appreciation for Jesus. Boaz was really, really good to Ruth, even when she startled him in the middle of the night. How much better is Jesus to us? I would hope that Boaz is nothing in your estimation in comparison to your relationship with Christ. So I'd encourage all of you to consider that. Thank you for paying attention. I went over. I'm sorry I held you up from lunch. Lunch is really important. But I appreciate your attention. Thank you guys for sticking with me.